part of our personal story and very much part of our collective and our universal story. And it is a characteristic of dukkha. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this word so far, I will unpack it in a moment, and by the end of this talk, you will be perhaps more familiar with it than you ever cared to be. let us think about what dukkha means. If we are, I think, to understand the landscape of mindfulness and the landscape of insight, we are asked to understand dukkha. If we're asked to understand compassion and kindness, we're asked to understand dukkha. And in reality, I think the awakening of our own heart and mind is rooted in this understanding of dukkha. Now, dukkha is a Pali word, which is sadly, very sadly, mistranslated as suffering. It's a great misfortune that that has happened, because it leads to some quite understandable aversion and to the terrible reputation that the Buddhist teaching gets as being rather depressing and grim, which it's anything but. But it's a translation that hardly renders justice to what dukkha actually means. So dukkha is, as I've mentioned earlier, what is unarguable, what is non-negotiable in this life. And the thread of dukkha runs through all of our lives from the moment of our birth to the moment of our death. The thread of dukkha runs through the lives of those we love and those we struggle with and the myriad of beings that we will never meet. It runs through all events and experiences, not just the unlovely, but also the lovely are tinged with dukkha. There is nothing that is exempt. There are no exceptions. Much of our lives can actually be dedicated to seeking for an exemption. Do we not see this in ourselves? Much of our lives can be dedicated to really some quite heroic efforts to constantly rearrange the conditions of our lives as much as we can to protect ourselves from dukkha. We construct an illusory island in our minds and in our lives of certainty, of safety, of reliability, of predictability, only to find that those islands dissolve time and time again. Now, on some level, when we hear that, it does sound a little grim, and it sounds a bit depressing. But I would suggest that it sounds grim and depressing only when dukkha is seen from the standpoint of fear and aversion. When dukkha is understood through the eyes of insight and compassion, we discover it's truly possible to lay down our arguments with the unarguable and to, in a very real way, just align our hearts and our lives with the simple truths of each moment. I think this is where we find peace. This is where we find compassion. This is where we find empathy and ease. And in reality, these may be the only true island that we can stand upon in the midst of all things. You know, the Buddha once reflected. He says, you know, it makes no sense that I, someone who is born, who is always changing, who is subject to death, would seek to find refuge in that which is also born, always changing and subject to death. It's actually quite a profound statement. How often in the very human uncertainties and anxieties that we feel in our lives, do we look outwardly to find something that's going to somehow console or protect us from that which we feel is difficult to bear. Understanding dukkha, I think, is the context for this entire pathway. It's where our lives converge. It is what we share. If we choose not to understand dukkha, the pathways we follow are almost predictable in their difficulty. Denial, often dissociation, disconnection, often feeling lost in aversion and craving and anxiety. If we choose to turn towards dukkha, which is what the Buddha suggested, it opens the doorways for compassion, for kindness, for a sense of connectedness, for our capacity to live our life fully. Understanding dukkha, I would say, is the embarkation point for this entire path of development. It is resting upon our willingness to turn towards our life, to investigate it. There are a lot of moments we don't want to know about dukkha. And this is understandable. It's very human. There's very many moments where we don't want to know about pain, where we don't want to know about loss, where we feel fearful in the face of uncertainty. And this is very human. It is not something to judge. But flight can become a habit. Abandonment can become a habit. Seeking camouflage can become a habit. And the worst thing about the habit of flight is that it really does close the door in a very real way to the understandings that do liberate our hearts and our lives, the understandings that lead to the end of fear and isolation. So I want to look at the three domains, or almost the three dimensions of what dukkha is. And this is why it's so untranslatable into a single word, because it has these nuances. Now, the first domain of dukkha is referred to simply as dukkha-dukkha. We could call it double dukkha. Or the pain of pain. The suffering of a painful feeling. We all live in a body. And we are all going to know this domain of dukkha. Not as an abstract theory, but as a very felt experience. I see my elderly parents. You know, they're very elderly. How life is so difficult. How much struggle there is just to get through a single day. How much heroic endeavor there is just to make life work. And I know we would all imagine and long to have these sort of graceful slides into the sunset at the end of our lives. The reality is, for many people, it is stumbling from one crisis to the next. And it is difficult. We may know this reality of dukkha-dukkha right now. You might be sitting with a pain in your body or a chronic illness. And we will age and we will experience more of this. And so many external conditions, this is no one's fault, so many external conditions affect the well-being of our body. And none of this we can control. You know, my definition of aging is that the times of actually feeling well between moments of feeling unwell, they get shorter and shorter. And as you age, you do a lot of body contemplation, you know, and you contemplate it together with others, you know, with your dentist and your gynecologist and your osteopath. You do increasing amounts of body contemplation in the company of others. The average age of someone experiencing their first chronic illness is 60. These are the ones that don't go away. For many people, it's much younger. The average age of a person apparently looking into a mirror and discovering they're starting to look like their mother or father. It's 32. And we see dukkha within ourselves. And when we look around us, you know, when you look around you in this room, you know that no one is exempt. We've probably all lost people we love. We've known the sorrow of grief. We've known the pain of pain. Dukkha. And we're all asked to face our own mortality, and the only uncertainty about our dying is when. And there's a lot of things we can do with dukkha, and I'll go more into detail about that later. But some of those reactions are not so skillful. I've never found denial to be particularly helpful. Well, that's actually not true. When I was younger, I did have a good go at it. But I've never found denial to be particularly helpful. I've never found disassociation to be particularly helpful. I've never found panic to be particularly helpful. But we so often move into those modes of, I just don't want this to be happening. And we can go into great extremes over that mode. You know, investing in the cosmetic industry. If you've ever come across that ad for a facial cream, by the way, that says that aging is optional. Don't be fooled. It is not. Mostly in the face of dukkha, we try to forget. We try to avail ourselves of the considerable distractions that are available to us just to forget what is happening. And there's a lot of support in our world for forgetfulness. We try to find consolation and reassurance. We get busy mostly. Mostly we get busy rearranging conditions, trying to manipulate conditions so we feel as armored and protected as we can be against this life so fearful of. I have to say that our avoidance techniques are not always unsuccessful. It's good to recognize this. You know, even in a moment of sort of passing discontent, we do feel particularly successful, you know, when we turn on the TV or go to the fridge and we just forget about it for a minute or two. You know, so not all of our avoidance techniques are unsuccessful. But their success has a certain limitation in terms of time. And then once again, it seems the uncontrollable or the unpredictable bursts forward into our life in the form of illness or frailty or pain. And we are asked once more to turn towards this life as it is. You know, this path, I think, is not about crisis management. It's not waiting for the drama or the crisis to arrive and then imagining we're going to be so prepared to embrace this. You know, I love that line from John Kabat-Zinn. He says, the time to weave your parachute is not when you're about to jump out of the plane. You know, this is a path of development, a present moment recollection. Recollecting the fragility, the innate vulnerability of our bodies, the reality that is part of our lives. It's a kind of mindfulness. You know, there's many monasteries that begin every day by chanting this recollection about aging, about dying, about mortality. And it's a kind of recollection that's not intended to make us rather morbid or gloomy, but to remind us to treasure, to remind us to live this life fully, and to remind us to foster the resilience and the courage and the compassion of a heart and mind that's really firmly planted in this life as it is, with all its joys and all its sorrows. And I wonder what it would be for us in our lives to start our day with that recollection, that remembering of mortality, that remembering of vulnerability, that remembering of the fragile nature of each of our lives. I suspect it's a recollection that may indeed have the power to radically change how we go into our day, which can often be just forgetful. Now, the second domain of dukkha is called in Pali Viparinama Dukkha. It describes the unsatisfactoriness, the simple unsatisfactoriness inherent in a world of conditions that is constantly changing and that is born and reliant upon other conditions. This too is not news for us. We have a wonderful city and we hope it will last, and it disappears. You know, the beautiful sunset replaced by clouds and rain. We meet have people in our lives who are suddenly unreliable, who change in ways that are difficult for us to embrace. We experience a lot of moments of disappointment. We lose people we love. My friend John speaks of the malice of inanimate objects. The computers that break down. The trains that are late. The cars that won't start. Have you ever had that feeling, life is just out to get me? Every moment of our lives, we stand on shifting sands of change and conditions, uncertainty, the world of conditions that's inherently unstable. Recognizing this for Viparinama Dukkha, it's not good news, it's not bad news, it's not right, it's not wrong. It simply describes the nature of all that is born. And the Buddha, as I mentioned earlier, describes this domain of understanding, this domain of dukkha, the most powerful of all insights. Now, sometimes we welcome this domain of dukkha. It's not emotionally neutral, by the way. We should never imagine that this unreliability and this change and this uncertainty is somehow effectively neutral. We really like this domain of dukkha when it benefits us, when our noisy neighbor moves away and the hum of the fridge turns off and the root canal is over, when an obsessive story comes to an end. We become in those moments, you know, really enthusiastic advocates of Viparinama Dukkha. Isn't it wonderful that everything changes? But there's a lot of change that doesn't feel so welcome, a lot of instability that doesn't feel so welcome, and that is met with aversion and fear. I think we see so embedded in the human psyche the desperate quest, the ongoing quest to find stability and certainty and safety. And of course, some of this is wise. We don't, you know, without that quest to find some stability, our lives could just dissolve into chaos. But we engage in a lot of behavior, I think, that is in this attempt to manage change in conditions that is actually very agitated. There's much more of an avoidance mechanism. And at times we find ourselves engaging in a good deal of clinging, that rather desperate but futile quest, the mechanism we mostly employ to deny change and to deny instability. A couple of years ago, someone close to me, that her partner almost died in a catastrophic car accident. And she said to me, you know, it is so shocking to really realize that everything you love and treasure could just disappear in a moment. And I said to her, but it's always been this way. It's always been this way. This is not something that is new. It's not something that's your fault. It's not because you're unlucky or unfortunate. It has always been this way. But we see how much we endeavor to use grasping almost as the mechanism to keep things in place, even though it is ineffective. The unsatisfactoriness, this is why the Buddha didn't use the word suffering. He says it's just unsatisfactory. It's unsatisfactory. It's unsettling. It's unsatisfactory, this instability and this constant change. What does it mean for us? It's not about denying life or withdrawing. It's not about seeing life as being meaningless. It's not about searching ever more heroically for more consolation, more refuge, more safety within that which cannot be grasped. Often we just don't want to know this. You know, sometimes when we fail at trying to make life the way we think it should be, you know, reliable and certain and predictable, we don't want to know this. And sometimes we think it's because we haven't just tried hard enough. You know, we take it as some sort of personal indictment or failure, you know, that we just haven't tried hard enough to make our life certain and to make our life safe. I think the compassion that is born of embracing the fragile nature of this life is a compassion that allows us to open. It allows us to live this life fully. So one thing the Buddha said, you know, listen to how this lands with you, that everything that arises will pass. Everything that is born will die. Everything that is built will fall. Everything that comes together will break apart. Everything that forms will change. And there's a small piece of poetry that says, you know, life flickers in the ocean of a thousand ills. Every in-breath is followed by an out-breath. Each night we go to bed and dream. Isn't it a miracle that we wake up still? And I think, what would our lives really look like now to live in the spirit of that understanding? That it would be an understanding that can become so embedded that it's really in our bones, that it informs every action, every word, every choice, that it shapes how we live our lives. You know, we have inherited a lot of teaching stories from the Buddha's life, and nobody knows whether these stories are true or not, so it doesn't really matter. I think it's useful to take them as teaching stories. But one of the teaching stories, which I think probably many of you are familiar with, really describes a turning point, a psychological and emotional turning point in the life of Siddhartha. And it's the story of Siddhartha leaving his father's home where he was so protected and beginning what he later called a noble search for enduring peace and happiness. A life fully rooted in responsiveness, without fear. And the story describes Siddhartha as a young person going out of his father's home and realizing, when faced with this aging and sickness and death, realizing that all of his status and all of his comfort and all of his distractedness were actually not going to be an ultimate protection against the winds of change and instability, or provide a lasting refuge. Now, we can have a very mixed relationship to the first two domains of dukkha, even though they're not news to anybody in this room. We can have very mixed reactions to the realities of aging and dying. It's not news to us that we can't control the world of conditions, although we don't quite believe it. This is amazing that we don't quite believe it. Yeah, I remember years ago going with my father to the supermarket, and I came out and I found him standing in the parking lot shouting at a shopping trolley. And I said to him, "Dad, what are you doing?" You know, and he says, "Well, somebody shouldn't have left that trolley in a parking space." You know, and he got into this rage about how the world should be. You know, and I said to him, "Dad, you know, that possibly there might be another way of approaching this." You know, and he says, "No, there isn't another way." He said, "People should obey the rules." And how many rules do we have in our minds? How many rules do we have in our minds about how the world should behave and how other people should behave, and how upset we get when our rules aren't obeyed or not observed? It's how it is. It's not news to us that our very life and our personal world is vulnerable and shifting. It could crumble in a moment. But we see again that this question I brought up earlier of dissonance. I'm so curious about dissonance. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so curious about it. This gap between our knowing and our living. You know, and this disconnection between our knowing and how we embody and absorb that knowing and that understanding. I'm just so curious about that gap. And I would hope I could encourage you to be curious about that gap too. I mean, I think for many people, dissonance becomes a real trigger for judgment and shame and blame. But, you know, I should be better at this. You know, I've been sitting for 40 years. I should be better at this. And yet we keep spotting those moments of dissonance. And rather than seeing them in a negative light, I think it's really important to see them creatively. This is a creative discomfort. It's a creative discomfort. It asks us to question, what is keeping dissonance in place? What is keeping that gap in place? When we know we can't grasp the ungraspable or control the uncontrollable, what leads us to heroically strive to do so? Knowing that every time we heroically strive to do so, we're almost writing a prescription for ourselves for unhappiness. Now, the story of Siddhartha leaving his parents' home is not so much a story about a geographical departure. It's a story of leaving this kind of home of illusions and pretense. It's a story about healing this dissonance, because this is where we begin to find the turning points in our own hearts and our lives, when we're willing to leave the constructions of our illusions. That is, I think, when dissonance begins to heal. And we find our own turning points. It's not about entering a life of bleakness or inertia, but it's about putting down our arguments with the unarguable and finding refuge in our own understanding, finding refuge in our own wakefulness and stillness. Which brings us to the third domain of dukkha. This is called sankhara or sankhata dukkha. And this is something I touched upon in the question time this morning. Now, the first two domains of dukkha, remember them, the pain of pain and the unsatisfactoriness of change and instability in the world of conditions, this is all unavoidable. You know, no matter how much we argue with it, we don't make it into something else. It's actually all unarguable. But the third domain of dukkha is the one that can be transformed and understood. This is the part of dukkha that this practice is so totally concerned with. The sankhata, understanding sankhata dukkha or sankhara dukkha, is the heart of all insight meditation. Now, sankhara dukkha is our personal, emotional, and psychological world that is constructed around the first two domains of dukkha. It's the world of our reactivity, our likes and our dislikes, our anxieties and our aversions and our judgments and our views and our shoulds. Sankhara dukkha is the world of our jealousy and our blame and our shame. And sankhara dukkha is an agitation. Sankhara dukkha is the builder of our narratives. It's the builder of our stories and our views. Sankhara dukkha is the builder of our view of self and our view of others. Sankhara dukkha is the builder of our views about how we and others and the world should be. Sankhara dukkha is the world of our preoccupations, our obsessions, our ruminations. And sankhara dukkha is also the world of self-construction, the world we build of who we are, or who we believe ourselves to be, that is based upon reactivity and clinging. Now, perhaps the best illustration of sankhara dukkha is in a teaching story that many of you will be familiar with, but it is a really crucial and precious one, so I'm going to repeat it. When an untaught being is touched by a painful bodily feeling, they worry and grieve. They lament and beat their breast, weep and become distraught. Thus they experience two kinds of feeling, a bodily and a mental feeling. It's as if a person were pierced by an arrow, and following the first injury, they are then hit by a second arrow. So that person will experience feelings caused by two arrows. But in the case of a well-taught person, when they're touched by a painful feeling, they will not grieve and lament. They will not beat their breast, nor become distraught. It is just one kind of feeling they experience, a bodily feeling, but not a mental reaction. It's as if that person was pierced by an arrow, but was not hit by a second arrow following the first. So that person experiences feeling caused by a single arrow also. You see that distinction? Now this passage primarily centers around what could happen around a bodily feeling, which is, you know, very important. You have a pain or an illness, and then you have all of the fears and the anxieties and the narratives and Google that's, that follows that first injury, right? That first injury. And we see this so clearly in our own experience. You know, you might walk out the door and you stumble over a pair of shoes and it hurts. You know, it might hurt if you stub your toe. It would hurt if you were a Buddha or not a Buddha. And then you can almost see the second arrow winging its way towards you, can't they? Who put those shoes there? You know, who is so unmindful that they put their shoes there? Oh, they're my shoes. I stumbled over my own shoes. I am such an unmindful person. It's my whole life has been this history of mindlessness and stubbing my toe, and I will probably always be like this. Can you just see the second arrow just winging its way? The stubbed toe hurt. Which is the most agitated? Which can be cared for most fully? The stubbed toe or the second arrow where we get lost? You sit and there's a pain in the back and you see, you know, I sort of have this image of sitting and going through life amidst this field of second arrows coming towards me. You sit and your back hurts, and immediately, the second arrow is right there. You know, this is telling me something about my future. You know, I'm always going to have this bad back. You know, and so many things in my life I'm not going to be able to do. I imagine the emergency board. You know, you eat something at lunchtime. You know, who was so insensitive as to put garlic on a meditator's buffet table? You know, we see that patterns of reactivity. The second arrow is just winging our way. We lose someone we love, and grieving is the first arrow, but it can move into a world of rumination and anxiety. We walk outside and we smile at someone, and you know, this is so often happens on retreat, and you get the stony look in return, you know. Oh no, you know, you can just see it coming. You can see the second arrow, you know. It's just like you're a sitting duck, you know. Oh no, it means I'm not lovable, you know, and that person doesn't like me, or maybe they're just a terribly cold and sensitive person, and they shouldn't be here if they're a cold and sensitive person. They should be doing something else, you know. You just see the becoming lost in this story. How many times does that happen in a day? How many times does it happen in a single day that we're living in the world of the second arrow? The good news, as the Buddha pointed out, is that this is not a life sentence. This is not a life sentence. And the primary work, I would say the very primary work of mindfulness, is to explore and to understand the possibility of severing, of cutting the connection between the first and the second arrows. This is what our practice is primarily concerned with. The Buddha taught there is dukkha and there is the end of dukkha. He was not talking about immortality or the end of pain or the end of having a body. He was talking about the ending of emotional anguish and psychological torment. He says there is an end of dukkha. Mindfulness cuts the link between the primary experience in our physical life, in our emotional life, in the rest of our life. Cuts the link between that primary experience and the underlying tendencies of craving and aversion, because these are the triggers for the narrative to be built. These are the triggers for the narrative, the stories to be constructed that lead to distress, that lead to despair. You know, from the perspective of evolutionary science, you know, some of these reactions of moving towards or moving away from, you know, these are very survival mechanisms. But mostly today, these reactions of moving towards and moving away from are actually really serving just to protect my view of self and my fear of the unknown and my fear of instability. And these, what become habitual reactions of craving and aversion, actually what they really do is that they serve to leech the joy and the peace and spaciousness from our lives and take us to places very far from where we want to be. Now, craving is a sankhara. It is a pattern. It is a habit pattern. It's a well-worn groove. It's also an agitation. And I think we can check this out in our own experience. In the grip of the craving impulse, we are also in the grip of something else. In the grip of the craving impulse that I need to get this, I need to have this, I need to possess this, I need this. In the grip of that impulse, we're also in the grip of a much deeper ideology, which is a sense of deficit, a sense of lack, a sense of incompleteness, a sense of insufficiency. Without that ideology, there is no ground for the craving impulse to take hold. Apart from the ideology that we are not enough, that we do not have enough, and that we do not have the capacity inwardly to have enough. So we find a poor substitute. We find a poor substitute for that sense of lack or that sense of incompleteness. And it comes about through prowling the world for more pleasant sensation, more pleasant experience, more pleasant events, more affirmation, the craving to be the kind of person who only has a particular set of experiences in this life. You know, the craving to be the kind of person who, you know, only has appreciation and success and praise and pleasant events. The craving to be the kind of person whose children always succeed and nothing goes wrong in their life. You know, I mean, please don't take this personally, anybody here who does this, but, you know, sometimes I get letters at Christmas time, you know, these letters that get sent to 100 people. And I'm always astonished at how anybody has managed to swing it, this world of conditions where everything is so good. You know, their kids are all doing well. They had fantastic vacations. You know, they moved to a wonderful house. Their job is amazing. You know, and their friends are here forever. And I think, wow, how did they manage to swing that? You know. But in a sense, you know, I think that's the kind of person we want to be. We want to be the kind of person who has only this kind of experience. We don't want to be the kind of person who would write a letter at Christmas time and said, you know, my kids are failing, my job, I've lost my job, you know, I'm getting a divorce and my life is miserable. We don't want to be that kind of person. You know, we want to be the other kind of person.
Yes.
So craving is what we do. We prowl the world to find what we feel that we do not have inwardly. And it's an agitation, isn't it? It triggers so much busyness. It triggers so much thought. It triggers so much imagining and speculating. And it triggers behavioral patterns. You know, just notice it in the day how much... it's kind of embarrassing sometimes how hardwired we seem to be to endlessly be seeking comfort and have such a low tolerance for discomfort. You know, I mean, as I mentioned, you know, in the beginning of the day, you know, I teach in a lot of retreat centers, which I consider to be sort of like heavenly realms on earth, you know, where conditions are so perfect, you know, particularly one where I teach in the States, you know, where conditions are so perfect, you know, that there's absolutely nothing lacking. And every day there'll be 10 notes about what's lacking. How we could improve. You know, we could actually stop hearing the sound of the wind so loudly if we put more. I think, no, this is not. Yeah, sometimes it's kind of embarrassing. Yeah, I mean, years ago, you know, living in Asia and, you know, when I was very young, and I certainly thought that my practice, deepening of my practice, relied upon having ideal conditions in the midst of this very unideal situation. You know, I remember living in a hut on the mountainside, practicing, deciding it was, you know, too close to the village. I'm further up the hill, you know, no cows went by in the day. I couldn't possibly find peace with cows going by in the day. Moved further up the mountainside, as far as I could go, the last hut, you know, put blankets on the windows, you know, thought I'd finally arrived at the ideal place to find peace, only to discover the local troop of monkeys love to jump on the tin roof of my hut every day. You know, and again, perhaps I'm a little bit like my father, but seeing myself outside shouting at the monkeys to go away, it suddenly dawned upon me, you know, that maybe I was placing the sense of where peace lies in a place that it couldn't be found. Aversion, craving and aversion, you know, they're very good friends. They're very good friends. And aversion is equally a pattern. It's a sankhara, an equally powerful trigger, because aversion has such a big extended family, doesn't it, of anxiety and rumination and worry and fear and ill will and judgment and shame. And here we, just as craving needs us to move outwards, aversion needs us to recoil, to flinch away from what is, from what we don't know how to embrace. And mostly what we don't know how to embrace is the first two domains of dukkha. mostly what we don't feel able to embrace is our vulnerability and instability and uncertainty and the fragile nature of our life. So we flee and abandon, but notice how the habit of abandonment feeds the habit of abandonment. Notice how the habit of disconnection feeds and fuels the habit of anxiety and fear. Notice how the habit of abandonment really takes us away from living this life as it is. And actually, when we abandon the moment, we also abandon the prospect and the possibility of happiness and resilience and courage, which rely upon us turning towards this life. So what is mindfulness doing? It's reversing these trends. You know, mindfulness is not just watching something. You know, mindfulness is reversing these powerful patterns and turning towards our ideologies of insufficiency and turning towards our patterns, our habits of abandonment, and learning that we can indeed meet the moment, meet this life with a gentle and a curious touch. Learning that we can stand upright and have some inner ground in the midst of dukkha and a life with all that it brings, the lovely and the unlovely. We learn with mindfulness that we can find the courage to embrace with an unwavering wakefulness each moment of this life as it is. Certainly we sense the whispers and the surges of craving and aversion, but we can sense those whispers without getting lost and without being overwhelmed. As the Buddha put it so simply, he says, you know, dukkha is to be understood. Dukkha is to be understood. And we come to see that how dukkha is responded to really lies in our hands. In the early verses of the Satipatthana Sutta, this kind of primary text in developing mindfulness and insight, it begins with the invitation to breathe in, calming the formations, to breathe out, calming the formations. And the formations are the patterns, the sankharas, the formations are everything that is agitated. Breathing in, alive to the present moment, and recollecting with kindness and with mindfulness what is here. This is no easy task. In truth, the Buddha referred to this as swimming against the tide. Swimming against the tide. It is swimming against the tide of our habit patterns. So swimming against the tide of all that is so familiar to us. Some years ago, I remember I went whitewater rafting and I got tossed out of the boat, as sometimes happens, which was actually quite scary because this was like a very fast river. And I knew that if I just kind of let go, I was on the rocks, you know. So I had to swim against this current. And at first it was kind of like... like a, you know, like a supercharged dog paddle, you know. But then I realized actually there was a way of doing this. There was a way of doing this. I knew where I had to go. You know, I knew what I needed to get to. And there was a kind of a sudden calm that came over me in doing that. You know, and also there were people who were helped. But it is, you know, we can swim against the tide in this agitated fashion, thinking, you know, oh, you know, I really need to wake up, you know, and I really need to, you know, treasure this life. Or actually, no. Okay, here's the tide of this habit pattern right now. Just now, I can just swim against it. I can just pause in that moment of craving. I can just pause in that moment of aversion. I can feel what it feels like. Is this a place of happiness? Is this a place of well-being? Can I befriend that? Can I actually be intimate with that, to know it, and to learn from it, to learn from it? I mean, I'm sure we're all very aware of the very powerful ways that craving and aversion are implicated, not only in constructing our world of the moment, but also implicit in building the narrative of me, in building the narrative of who I am, the narrative of fear, the narrative of insufficiency, the narrative of unworthiness. And have you noticed that craving and aversion only ever builds a narrative of incompleteness? That craving and aversion only ever builds a narrative of imperfection, of what is wrong. That's something so interesting to explore, because that the craving and aversion is inviting in so many of those second arrows, and those second arrows begin to construct a story of who I am. And it's never a story of, oh yes, I've done what needs to be done. You know, it's not a story of peace, it's not a story of well-being. It's a story of what I need to fix, what I need to improve, what I need to get, what I don't have, what I need to get rid of, what I can't bear, everything that's wrong with me. Craving and aversion, interesting, only builds this story of incompleteness, of limitation and imperfection. So we see that craving and aversion are sankharas, or patterns, that actually trigger other sankharas and patterns. Sankharas of agitation, of restlessness, of doubt, of numbness, and of course, the agitation of me. The agitation of the self story. Notice how this very rarely builds around generosity, calmness, peace, well-being. You know, we don't have a lot of story about that, do we? You know, you sit in your life, you know, and you feel quite well and quite peaceful, quite spacious. It's very rarely then that we say, oh, why am I so spacious, you guys? Well, why am I so compassionate, you know? Why am I so peaceful? It just doesn't build a big story, does it? The volume gets turned down very low. But notice craving and aversion and being triggered by, you know, when stories of selfing are triggered by craving and aversion, how they centralize around imperfection and reify imperfection. These are all second arrows. And of course, in the midst of all of this chaos, of course, like good meditators, we tell ourselves we should let go. We should let go of our stories. We should let go of our obsessions. We should let go of our constructions. And have you noticed how spectacularly ineffective that command is? It's even worse when somebody else tells you you should let go. But have you noticed how desperately failing it is, that command, I should let go. I just need to let go. We shouldn't be surprised that it's ineffective. We shouldn't be at all surprised. It's almost if we imagine that one sankhara, one pattern, has the power to let go of another sankhara, another pattern. It simply doesn't work in this world. One pattern does not let go of another pattern. They are interwoven. Because the sense of me really can't be separated from my story, can it? We have this illusion of this autonomous I that somehow has this undiscovered power to step up to the plate and let go. Simply doesn't work. I love the description by Paul Brooks, neuropsychiatrist who spent his entire professional life trying to find this unified self. He says, we have an illusion of unity. The mental processes underlying our sense of self, feelings, thoughts, memories, are scattered through different zones of the brain. There's no special point of convergence, no cockpit of the soul, no soul pilot. They come together in a work of fiction. A human being is a storyteller. The self is a story. That is not to say our lives are fiction. We are embedded in a universe with physical and moral dimensions, where every thought and action splinters into a million consequences. Who tells the story of self? That's like asking who thunders the thunder, or who rains the rain. It's not so much a question of us telling the story, as the story telling us. the story telling us who we are. Breathing in, calming the agitations. Breathing out, calming the agitations. Moment to moment, we are mindful of and we investigate all that is agitated. And they do begin to calm. And I think we do begin to get a sense that a life of true peace is a life where we really do put down our arguments with the unarguable, that we align our hearts and our lives with change and with uncertainty. Then the second arrows of aversion, agitation, anxiety, craving, selfing can all begin to calm. This path is very much dedicated to a very deep inner happiness, a deep inner peace, where our hearts and minds are truly a friend, where we find within ourselves a courage and a balance and understanding that's truly a refuge for us. And that life, that understanding, I think, is the one that gives birth to creativity, to compassion, to engagement, to sensitivity, and to a sense of fullness in the wisest way in this life that we live. Okay, thank you. I think that's where I want to end. Thank you.